Every network, every cable channel, every newspaper streams the contaminated code of Bushwellian patriotism, conformity, and non-thought.
The plan stated that the United States needs to have complete control of the Middle East oil.
The streets are owned by looters and thieves. Many people are afraid to go to the hospital. There's no telephone service to call an ambulance.
This military invasion of Iraq cannot become a pattern if we expect to have any kind of peaceful stability.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, May 28, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Saudi Interior Minister announced the arrest of more militants believed to have had a role in the Riyadh bombings, including a man identified by Saudi newspapers today as an Al-Qaeda suspect who allegedly masterminded the attacks. Also today, the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Robert Jordan, said the United States was not involved in Saudi plans to seek the extradition of any Saudis who may be among Al-Qaeda members held in Iran and could have a role in the Riyadh bombings. The U.S. has accused Iran of harboring Al-Qaeda suspects linked to the Riyadh bombings, charges Iran denies. In the months leading up to the Iraq War, the Pentagon ignored warnings that it would need a substantial military police force to provide law and order in the post-war chaos. The London Guardian reports that Robert Perito, a former diplomat who designed a police mission in Haiti 9 years ago, put together a detailed plan on how to deal with the expected lawlessness, and he warned that regular troops trained to shoot or kill or retreat were not right for the job. Perito briefed the Defense Policy Board, a Pentagon advisory panel, in February, and he said the board had appeared to agree with his conclusions that no action was taken. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan held a press conference yesterday to announce the appointment of Sergio de Mello, the UN's top human rights official, to serve as special representative in Iraq for a four-month period. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with our correspondent Aaron Glantz, who recently returned from Baghdad. We asked him a bit about de Mello's background.
Well, what I can tell you, Verna, is that when he was tapped to head the UN Commission on Human Rights, he was at that point envoy to Indonesia, where, of course, America has a very checkered human rights record, where he had not endeavored to make any comment on that human rights record. And it's important to remember how it is exactly that he became the chief of human rights for the United Nations. People may remember Mary Robinson. She was the human rights chief for the United Nations on September 11th. And she was very critical of the civilian casualties of the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. She was extremely critical and condemned the indefinite detention without trial of Taliban prisoners that are still being held today in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. She was harshly critical of the Israeli military's invasion of Jenin, and she was also extremely critical of the rounding up of immigrants in the United States after September 11th. So when her term was coming to an end as the UN human rights chief, she stepped aside knowing that the United States would veto another term for her. I remember calling the U.S. mission to the United Nations at the time and talking to one of the officials there, an assistant to John Negroponte, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., who said very plainly that Mary Robinson was no longer acceptable to the United States and that they had told her as such and given her the opportunity to step aside or be vetoed. And then the United States put forward this man to head the Human Rights Commission. You may notice that you no longer see statements of condemnation coming from this man, unlike Mary Robinson. And so it should not surprise people that he would be someone that Kofi Annan could appoint who would be amenable to Washington.
Aaron, you recently left Baghdad, Iraq, after staying there for several weeks and reporting for Peace Watch. Can you give us the latest on the humanitarian situation, both in terms of the health of the Iraqi people and the rebuilding of Iraq's infrastructure after the bombings?
Well, some people may have heard about a cholera epidemic in Basra. Epidemic is probably a strong word. So far, there are only maybe a dozen cases of cholera reported in Basra and a handful reported in places like Baghdad. But this is extremely worrying to health officials because cholera has the ability to spread like wildfire, and the health system overall is not in a very good situation. And there aren't necessarily the drugs, not only because of the war, but because of the previous sanctions regime, to treat diseases like this. There is also the overwhelming cause of death right now. I would say the leading cause of death is diarrhea, because many of the water treatment plants are not able to act at full capacity because there isn't enough electricity to run them, and there isn't enough spare parts because of the sanctions to fix them. Also, pipe systems of Baghdad are in woefully bad repair, and so you have large pools of stagnant water around the city, which is not good for the health either, and indicates where some of the impurities in the drinking water that comes out of the tap, when it comes, may be coming from. The hospitals themselves are in various conditions depending where you go in Baghdad. But one of the overall difficulties is that doctors are not necessarily getting paid, which is, for obvious reasons, reducing their attendance at the hospital. And another big problem for the hospitals and the health of Iraqi people is the horrible security situation and the fact that the streets are owned by looters and thieves, and so many people are afraid to go to the hospital. There's no telephone service to call an ambulance still, so if you need an ambulance, somebody has to go run to the hospital to call one. And a problem with that is that there's a horrible shortage of gasoline for cars, so you need to wait 15 hours to get gas for your car. So you can just imagine trying to go to the hospital if you just need to fill up your tank first.
Aaron, over the weekend, UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, warned that post-war Iraq could face a major crisis without immediate world attention and action to meet its pressing needs, such many as you mentioned, such as the sanitation, the lack of clean drinking water, the removal of U.S. ordnance left over from the war. In your travels around the country, did such a crisis seem imminent to you?
I'll tell you this, Verna. There are a tremendous number of American troops on the ground in Iraq, and you see them everywhere. You see them driving their tanks on the streets of Baghdad. You see them having taken over schools in Fallujah and having occupying bridges in Kut. But then, when you look for the American troops that are trying to fix the civil infrastructure, fix the power plants, the telephone lines, to repair the hospitals that were damaged in the war, to work over the pipe system that I mentioned is being damaged, you don't find any. I was working on a story a few weeks ago about a Palestinian refugee camp that's in the middle of Baghdad, and I wanted to go talk to the American administrators of the civilian affairs to find out what is the reason that they're living in tents as opposed to in buildings. And when I went to go talk to the civilian affairs, for one-third of Baghdad, responsible for over 2 million people, I found that the American presence in this office was three officers, one major, one person manning the radio, and one person guarding the door. And it's very puzzling to most Iraqis why the American administrator, the occupying power that freed them from Saddam Hussein, is not doing more to make their lives more bearable.
And what about the mass looting that we've heard and that you've reported on as well that was taking place across the country? Has that subsided at all over the past several weeks, or is it still just as rampant and just as much chaos?
Well, people are still afraid to go outside. Everyone is still home by 6 or 7 o'clock at night because they're afraid of the looting. I myself noticed that there was a significant drop-off in gunfire outside my own window during the time that I stayed in Baghdad over 3.5 weeks, that when we first arrived, starting at about 7 o'clock in the evening and going until about 8 o'clock in the morning, there was a steady stream of gunfire outside. Now it seems to just go in fits and starts. But still, the statistics that we hear are that there are still about 10 to 12 murders a night in Baghdad, which when you add it up, of course, is over 3,000 murders in 1 year. But at the same time, you do see shops that are open selling televisions, for example, and other expensive items that you would have never seen open shortly after the war because people were afraid to open their doors. People feel better about the new head of the American Occupation Force, Mr. Bremer, than they did about Garner. Everyone is very happy that General Garner is gone. They felt like he wasn't doing anything. And there's some hope and expectation that J. Paul Bremer may be better, although it will be very difficult for him to go through this process that he's talking about in terms of making all Iraqis, except for the Kurds, turn in their guns by June 14th, since nearly every Iraqi household has a gun, and many of them feel like they need it to protect themselves from the looting.
Mm. And what of fighting gunfire between Iraqis and the military there? We are hearing reports that many American soldiers continue to be killed on a regular basis, I think as many as one a day.
Yeah, and there was this report yesterday from Fallujah, where, of course, the Americans shot and killed 18 people last month, that there was an attack on the Americans yesterday in Fallujah. I think this has to be put in a context, which is that the vast majority of Iraqis, the sense on the street is that people are very happy with the American the idea of an American presence, I should say, that they're very happy that the Americans are there instead of Saddam Hussein, and that they wish they were doing a better job of keeping the peace. They wish they were doing a better job of providing essential services, but there isn't this kind of anti-American sentiment across the vast population. But, of course, in a country of 25 million people, all of whom are armed, there will be some people who will be against the Americans, and the big question, of course, one of them is, who are the people who are killing the American soldiers? The American officials are very quick to link this to Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath party, but it's not clear that this is in fact the case. The thing that I'm most worried about is that when you walk around the streets of Baghdad, the average American soldier and the average Iraqi have a very good interaction. The average American soldier goes and buys ice cream and talks to the Iraqi people. Children come up and talk to the American soldiers, and it's a very friendly occupation. But if these attacks on the Americans continue, the Americans may be put in a position where they adopt a more hostile occupation attitude, like the kind of occupation you see, for example, in the West Bank by the Israeli army. And if that happens, it will be an extremely dark time for Iraq.
Aaron, finally, the UN Security Council voted late last week to lift the 12-year-old economic sanctions against Iraq that UNICEF once estimated were responsible for the deaths of 5,000 children a month. Do you foresee this move as lifting any sort of weight from the shoulders of average Iraqis? And how long will it be before they actually experience the concrete effects of life without the sanctions?
Well, I mean, I think one important thing to consider, Verna, is that this program, which used to be administered by the United Nations, will now effectively be administered by the United States of America, which will be in charge of everything about the Iraqi economy. So what this means is that America and the Bush administration will be in charge of buying things, of paying people, of selling oil, of every aspect of the Iraqi economy. So it really depends on how much you trust the Bush administration to share this wealth from the Iraqi oil with the Iraqi people. Everything, of course, in Iraq is in a state of collapse. As I mentioned, the water treatment plant, one reason why the water in Baghdad is so bad is not necessarily because of the war, but because for 13 years it was very difficult for them to buy spare parts for the water treatment system. So all of these things will have to be replaced. The Americans will take the money, presumably from the sale of oil, and do it and spend spend the money on things like paying salaries. An important thing to remember about the Iraqi economy is that it was a socialist economy under Saddam Hussein. So jobs that would be filled by the private sector in America, for example, a cigarette factory, are government jobs in Iraq, which means that the people who work at the cigarette factory have not been paid. The architects of Iraq have not been paid. Any professional in Iraq mostly has not been paid since the end of the war. And so the Americans will be put in a position of deciding how much back pay to give people. And these are the important issues that Iraqi people will be looking at over the next year or so to find out what the intentions of America are. And finally, at what point America will begin to take a step back and allow the Iraqi people to run their own affairs.
Peace Watch reporter Aaron Glantz recently returned from Baghdad, Iraq. We reached him in Ankara. President-elect George Bush and the neoconservatives have come under criticism from political analysts for the administration's policy of preemptive strikes and what has been seen as the erosion of civil liberties under the so-called Patriot Act. Peace activists and celebrities have been ostracized for expressing opposition to the invasion of Iraq. Today, Harvey Wasserman of Columbus Free Press offers this unique critique in a commentary entitled "Reloading to Fight the Bush Matrix."
The mystery is solved. The Matrix is about the fight against the Bush Republican totalitarian takeover. The code is clear, the message unmistakable. Humankind must focus all its love of freedom and all that's human against the Rove Cheney Bush assault on spontaneity, thought, and nature. Victory is possible, but only with a new level of wit and perseverance, compassion, and love. The sneering, evil Agent Smith is a George Bush, Dick Cheney clone with his metal heart and gray-suited legions of smirky, self-replicating corporate drones. The mastermind programmer, inventor of the totalitarian matrix, can only be Karl Rove, calm, cold, calculating, committed to exterminating all free thought and choice. Their nemesis has evolved, as we must, beyond neocon or neoliberal. Neo is the common man Superman, powered by passion, inseparable from his lover Trinity, and from the multiracial crew that supports them both. Hokey? Hell yes. But this massively expensive extravaganza has chosen to dress its Hispanic, Black, Oriental, geek heroes and heroines in ratty sweaters and hip-hop attitudes. The Oracle is an African-American earth mother, sitting on a Rosa Park bench in the graffiti-laden courtyard of an inner-city tenement. Her bodyguard is a cross between Jackie Chan and Yoko Ono. An unlikely human hero, the Keymaker, is the kind of guy Bush would lock up if we were at war with Japan or Korea, as if he could tell the difference. See the movie. Think about the latest media-embedded nonsense now claiming it's hip to be Republican. Every network, every cable channel, every newspaper streams the contaminated code of Bushwellian patriotism, conformity, and non-thought. Homeland Security? The Bush Matrix wants to arrest all those ravers at the Zion sex dance early in the film. Its draft-dodging Top Gun has the clonable face and poisonous smirk of every agent the Matrix sends to kill off dissenters. This film sends a grim but powerful message in its image of humankind's last refuge from the machines, a treeless, airless Zion. Is this where we all must flee when the Bush Matrix finally wipes out the natural planet? When Neo suddenly finds himself facing snow-covered mountains, it comes as a shock that air and snow still exist at all. A sure reminder, by contrast, of the barren death tunnel to which the shrub, hate-nature, eco-terrorists seem determined to drive us. From Blade Runner to Time Machine, from 12 Monkeys to Escape from New York, it's no accident we've seen such bleak visions before. With every passing day, the corporate polluters' Apocalypse Express takes us closer to a post-natural purgatory. For all its super-hyped psychobabble, The Matrix provides a simple warning against just that. All the bloviation and streaming computer code are there to send a single message. The totalitarian mind is upon us, and we must fight back. Call it the Matrix or call it the Republican media monopoly. In each realm, film and real, Those who fight to preserve humankind's right to make choices are still alive, but barely. We don't know exactly how Matrix 3 will turn out. At least Matrix 2 leaves the humans alive to fight another day. Will those of us fighting Bush 2 be able to say the same? It's up to us, but we have no choice.
Harvey Wasserman is senior editor of the Columbus Free Press, an independent newsletter. Their website, www.freepress.org.
Americans no longer fight to keep their shores safe, just to keep the jobs going in the arms-making workplace. And then they pretend to be gripped by some sort of political reflex. But all they're doing is paying dues to the military-industrial complex. The military and the monetary. The military and the monetary. The military and the monetary. The military and the monetary get together whenever they think it's necessary. They turn our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet into a cemetery. The military and the monetary use the media as intermediaries. They are determined to keep the citizens secondary. They make so many decisions that are arbitrary. We're marching behind the commander-in-chief who was standing under a spotlight shaking like a leaf. But the ship of state had landed on an economic reef, so we knew he was going to bring us messages of grief. The military and the monetary were shielded by January and went storming into February. Brought us pot-bellied generals as luminaries. 2 weeks ago, I hadn't heard the sumbitch. Now, all of a sudden, he's legendary. They took the honor from the honorary. They took the dignity from the dignitary. They took the secrets from the secretary. But they left the bitch an obituary. The military and the monetary from thousands of miles away in a Saudi Arabian sanctuary had us all scrambling for our dictionaries because we couldn't understand different vocabulary. Yeah, there were some smart bombs, but there were some dumb ones as well. Scared the hell out of CNN in that Baghdad hotel. The military and the monetary, they get together whenever they think it's necessary. War in the desert sometimes sure is scary, but they beamed out the war to all their subsidiaries. Tried to make so damn insane a worthy adversary, keeping the citizens secondary, scaring old folks into coronaries. The military and the monetary from thousands of miles in the Saudi Arabian sanctuary kept us all wondering if all of this was really, truly necessary. We've got to work for peace. Peace ain't coming this way. If we only worked for peace, if everyone believed in peace the way they say they do, we'd have peace. The only thing wrong with peace is that you can't make no money from it. The military and the monetary, they get together whenever they think it's necessary. They've turned our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet into a cemetery. We've got to work for peace. Peace ain't coming this way. We should not allow ourselves to be misled by talk of entering a time of peace. Peace is not the absence of war. It is the absence of the rumors of war and the threats of war and the preparation for war. Peace is not the absence of war. It is a time when we will all bring ourselves closer to each other, closer to building a structure that is unique within ourselves, because we have finally come to peace within ourselves. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. Get together whenever they think it's necessary. They have turned our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning.
Senior Bush administration officials postponed a meeting at the White House yesterday that was scheduled to discuss U.S. strategy towards Iran. The meeting, rescheduled for tomorrow, comes in light of recent intelligence information the administration says suggests Iranian al-Qaeda operatives played a role in the May 12th suicide attacks in Saudi Arabia. Those attacks killed 11 and injured 200 in Western housing compounds in the capital, Riyadh. Peace Watch spoke yesterday with Samin Royanian, a Iranian-American economist and co-founder of the group Women for Peace and Justice in Iran.
If we go back and look at the Kissinger plan that was put in place after the embargo of oil in 1973, the plan stated that the United States needs to have complete control of the Middle East oil, and in fact it cannot depend anymore on governments which are friendly to the U.S., but America has to control the oil fields. In fact, they stated at the time that we need to have people from Texas and Oklahoma to run the oil fields in Middle East.
How much oil does Iran have and where is it located?
Iran, in terms of production of oil, maybe like the fourth or fifth producer. And also the significance of Iran in addition to that, most of the oil producing fields of Iran are in two areas. One area is in Abadan, which is the Iranian state next to the border with Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is the newly found oil in the Caspian Sea area. And that is why Iran is also additionally important to the U.S. policy in Middle East, because Iran may have a lot of influence among the Caspian Sea states, which have a lot of oil now. And United States want to control the Central Asian oil, the Caspian Sea area, and the Persian Gulf oil. And Iran is settled between these two, the Caspian Sea and the Persian Gulf. And also another importance of Iran is that it is a very direct route for transporting oil and gas from the Caspian Sea areas to the Persian Gulf to be used in the rest of the world. At this time, because there is a problem with Iran, they have started having a gas pipeline be drawn through Turkey, which is economically not very effective and useful. And also the important thing is that Iran is sitting on the Persian Gulf, which is really the gate where the ships go in order to carry the oil. And that's why during the war between Iran and Iraq, the American Navy was sitting there protecting the waters for being able to the oil ships, oil carriers to go through. So from many different points, Iran is very significant in the U.S. policy for Middle East, which is the complete control of the Middle East resources, because they have stated in the Project for New American Century that it is important for the United States to be able to control the resources so that they can control China, Japan, and Russia as well.
Mm-hmm. And so, Samin, very briefly, what are you hoping will come out of this meeting that's been postponed until Thursday?
Oh, I'm not hoping for anything. I think that whatever will come out of it will be very negative for Iran. At this point, U.S. is determined to take control of Iran, and I believe that in the absence of an amazing change, they will probably be successful to bring about a regime change in Iran. I mean, the chances of them being successful is very high. Mm. Something may happen just as it happened in Venezuela and the people would oppose them strongly, but that is not as possible because Chavez is a much more popular leader than the Islamic government is today in Iran. So it depends on the people of Iran. The only possibility is if for any reason the U.S. decides to continue talks and hope for reform in Iran. But truly, I don't believe that. And I believe the important issue here is for the American people, especially the peace and justice people, to be very aware and start doing something about it today and to prevent this war continuing to Iran.
Samin Royanian is a Iranian-American economist and a co-founder of the group Women for Peace and Justice in Iran. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.